This is where normal comes to die. Mediocrity meets its final demise, and the status quo is unabashedly dismantled. Welcome to Reinvention Radio. Now, here's your host, Steve Ulscher.
All right, very cool. So, Jordan, I know you're a crazy busy dude, and I just wanted to acknowledge you for taking the time to join us here today on a very, very special episode of Reinvention Radio. And if you're, and I'm just going to jump straight in here, guys, because if you're not familiar with Jordan, you're probably sleeping under a rock somewhere, because what he's doing with the Art of Charm and other really interesting things, actually, that I want to talk about is pretty, I mean, it's just nothing short of amazing. I could read your bio, but why don't you just kind of give us like the Jordan 12-second version for those that that may not know you?
Yeah, that works. What if I just read my own bio? That would be super tacky.
Right?
It's not the worst when people try to introduce you and they're like, Jordan has a BA from the University of Michigan, and it's like all irrelevant info. What it does is it makes me want to rewrite my bio. Because
just to say something really like fucked up, you know, just to see if they'll read it verbatim.
Yeah, and be like, you know... I don't even know. It's like, this is only useful in print. But anyway, I'm the co-host, or the host anyway, at this point, of the Art of Charm podcast. And it's one of the largest podcasts in the world, which is kind of funny because it started in a basement, which is where I assume where it looks like I'm in a basement now, which so I've only moved up a couple of floors since then and a couple of states. But we founded the Art of Charm as well as a company. It's a training company that teaches people from all over the world advanced social skills, negotiation, reading, nonverbal communication, charisma, personal magnetism. And we have a live training program literally every week in LA. So it's pretty crazy. It went from, hey, maybe eventually we can get some free eBooks or, you know, talk to experts occasionally, to let's see how, you know, this is not, now it's an eight-figure business. And it's like, how did that happen?
Yeah. And I mean, it's just kind of funny how I do a lot of work around helping people discover, share, and monetize the one thing they were born to do. And we've chatted about that before. And so what, you know, I think is really interesting here is when you first started out, you know, what I love about your story is when you first started out, you were just doing it because it's something you wanted to do. It's something you enjoyed doing. And, you know, it's kind of like, let me just have some fun with this. But after all said and done here, I mean, you've turned it into a pretty lucrative operation. Can you speak just for a second to how you might encourage folks to kind of forget about the money first and just really focus and hone in on who they are and what they're most really compelled to do? And then how do you transition into some of the monetary aspects of businesses you guys have been able to do so well with Art of Charm?
Sure. So do you want to break that down into a few distinct or discrete questions? So that
I don't even know what I asked you at this point.
I knew it. You're like, hope he just goes with that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So why don't we take a step back and talk about, I mean, essentially there's a couple questions in there, or there's multiples, but one that I heard that immediately sort of resonated is a lot of folks, they do this thing where they're like, well, I don't know what to do with myself. And I'm not here to tell you what to do with your life. I have no idea. I was a lawyer in the beginning, you know, and on Wall Street. I am like the last person probably that should tell you what to do with your life, because I started a business that took forever to get off the ground, was essentially reinvented or invented an industry that turned into essentially a self-help brand that's largely dependent on me and fresh content. I mean, it's like really an uphill battle. It's not something I would recommend other people dive into. And it's funny because I see copycat companies and coaches and life coaches and other kind of things like that. They're like, oh, well, these guys are making money doing it. And they're only looking at the outside and looking at how simple it looks to do this. They're like, I'll put my face on a webpage and I'll talk into a microphone, .. profit. And it's really like one of the worst places to make money. The reason we're able to do it is because we're probably one of the top, if not the top, in the space, right? You look at companies, people routinely call us and go, look, it's between you guys and Tony Robbins. And, you know, I've already done a Tony Robbins class and I love it. So I'd be gambling with you guys. And we routinely have to compete against that. It's not like people aren't saying, do I go learn hypnosis or do I come to your program? I mean, there's a lot of different things that people are looking at. And it's flattering to be in the same bucket as that. But it's not something where you can just make money from home online, you know, like a lot of these internet marketer type guys are trying to convince people is possible.
And what a lot of people, I don't think, recognize is this is not an overnight thing. I mean, your podcasts go back for years. So what was the, when was the first official Art of Charm podcast released?
2006.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, wow, a lot of people think, geez, you know, let's get this podcast game. We'll get 1 million downloads next month. And I mean, you've been at this for, you know, 9 years.
Yeah. I mean, that's what people don't get is they're like, well, wait a minute. You're still doing this show that started in 2000. Its podcast didn't even exist then. And, you know, I get that all the time. I'm like, yeah, they did. And, or at least, I mean, nobody knew about them. And they were so new that when we started, there were 800 shows in iTunes. And me and AJ, my co-host and still business partner, we were like, no one's going to find this. There's 800 shows in there. This is just going to be a hobby. And that was, we didn't care. That was like the whole point, right? It was just a hobby. It was like, let's drink and talk because we're already talking and drinking. We might as well turn on a microphone. You know, what's the difference? And that was how the show started and kind of how it still is in a lot of ways. I just do less drinking during the show. Although, to be honest, I don't know why. but it's not like something where we went, okay, we're going to monetize this. And I think that's one of the chief mistakes that people make, not only when they start a podcast. I mean, now there's 300,000 shows in iTunes instead of 800 under 1,000 or whatever it was when we started. So you're not going to get discovered. You're not going to monetize. And I know I sound like, what is it, like
Debbie Downer?
But look, I mean, you're not going to make money doing it. So just if that's why you're doing it, then quit now instead of in a half a year when you're like banging your head against the wall and you've bought all these info products about making money in podcasting. It's just trendy. It's going to be another bubble that pops. It's like the last year or the year before that was foreign exchange currency trading BS. You buy the system and you make money, and you know, it's penny stocks and other days, another thing that people short this company, do that. It's just trendy. The reason that there are podcasts that make money podcasting, because people will point to evidence about that. They'll say, well, look, so-and-so is making money doing it. Well, are they making money podcasting, or are they making money selling you a product on how to make money online? What are they actually making money doing? How many listeners do they have? You know, the Art of Charm has 2 million, between 1.5 and 2 million downloads a month, depending on how many shows we release and things like that. I know everybody thinks they're super magnetic personality, but people don't come looking for me. They come looking for my guests. So put your own personality out of the equation. Are you going to be able to get those celebrities to come on your show? If the answer is no, well, then you're not going to monetize. Sorry.
No, it's a great point. And I think it's actually pretty apropos. I don't even know if I didn't know this actually when we booked this, but today's International Podcast Day. So happy International Podcast Day, Jordan.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. But all right, so take us back then through when you look at the Art of Charm in its sort of embryonic stages. I mean, you've got a really interesting story. I mean, you still do a lot of really interesting things. But for people that are kind of struggling, you know, looking to come up with a concept or something of that nature, how was the Art of Charm born? Maybe just take us back through sort of those embryonic days.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened was I was in law school and I did what's called a summer associate program with a white shoe firm. So think fancy old Wall Street law firm, except mine, instead of being uptight, stuffy, old white guys, it was a bunch of young guys from like Brooklyn and Queens in New York who were, you know, Italian folks, Dominican guys, just like a really cool environment full of real New York culture in so many ways. And it was awesome. And I worked there, and this guy who hired me, his name was Dave, and he was from Brooklyn and he had a tan. So I knew he knew something that nobody else did, because that's not something normal. And he was never in the office. And I thought, okay, if you're supposed to be a lawyer and bill hours, that's like how we make money. How come you make more money than everybody else? He had this rep as like this badass partner who was always, he made more money than everybody else. And yet he was never there. So I was super confused by this. This made no sense to me, right? How come this guy was never in the office, but he made the most amount of money And so one day I asked him, because I was not getting any attention from my program. He was supposed to be my mentor, and he kind of wasn't. So I told him, I was like, hey, how come everybody says you make more money, but you're never in the office? And he said, wait a minute, people say that? And I said, yeah. And he said, okay, well, here's what happens. I bring in all the deals, and I have all the client connections, and I've got all of the relationships, for lack of a better word. And that's why I get paid more. Because I asked him if he just billed hours from home, and he said, well, no, I don't just bill the hours from home. I actually am out at events, and I meet people, and I play golf, and I do jujitsu, and I go on cruises and stuff. And I thought, that's rad. I've got to do that, because I'm not the smartest guy in this firm, and I'm not the hardest worker in the firm. Not that I'm like lazy and I don't like to work. I don't like that. I'm a super hard worker. I've always gotten things in my life by outworking everybody. But once you get to the top, you meet guys who are like, look, I left my family in X country. I have no friends here other than you guys. I'm here to work, make money, send it home, bring over my aging parents. I mean, you're never going to outwork those guys. As a 25-year-old kid, you can work as hard as them, but that means sleeping under your desk and working 24/7. And so it's not worth it. So I thought my lever is going to be doing the same thing that Dave does, is leveraging these relationships. And you had to do that, because think about this. If I try to outwork everybody, I work as hard as them. Maybe I outwork some of them. I'm miserable. If I try to be smarter, it means studying and learning everything that this firm does and making it better and learning from other people in the firm. That's great. But then I'm still what? At best, at par with everyone else, on par with everyone else. I wanted to be better than everybody else, a harder worker, make more money like Dave did. So I really thought that's the lever. That's the lever where I don't have to be in this office 24/7. And I'm kind of like the man, just like Dave, after a few years or several years. And so I started focusing on relationship skills and networking skills. And I read all the psychology, and I took Dale Carnegie classes and things like that. But here's the problem. When you're taking classes designed for corporate consumption, if you will, Dale Carnegie classes, the book is amazing, but the classes are kind of like, oh, are you the antisocial person in the office who doesn't look people in the eye and doesn't create any kind of impression? Here's some quick tricks to remembering people's names. And look, you can speak in front of a room of 10 people because we're going to make you give a little presentation and look people in the eye and shake hands and pause and make eye contact. And I'm like, this is not the essence of charisma. This is step one of 100. Where's the real deal? And then I remember kind of thinking to myself, well, the guy's teaching this class is nice, and he's okay, but he's not exactly the kind of guy where I would like run into battle with this guy. I wouldn't want this guy as my boss. In fact, he seems like he's kind of underemployed, and you know, he's teaching Dale Carnegie classes to like make ends meet, but he's a school teacher by day. And I don't mean any disrespect to school teachers or anything. My parents are that, but what I do mean is, shouldn't I be learning this from guys like Dave who are really doing it at the high level and can show me how? There's no place to learn that. You have to learn it yourself by seeking out the right mentors. And the problem is, mentors don't have time for you. They don't give a shit if you succeed or not. They're busy. So it's very, very tough. So I started to take the things that I read in these psychology books and these Dale Carnegie books and these classes, and I started to go out and apply them. And what I found was, oh, look, a lot of this stuff doesn't even work. Not the Dale Carnegie stuff, but a lot of the stuff in these leadership books doesn't work. And I thought it was me. So I traveled to meet some of the authors and things like that, and they weren't that charismatic themselves. And I thought, wait a minute, you're like an academic? How did you write a book on leadership? Well, I've conglomerated all the studies from the last 20 years. And like, you've never led anything. You looked at academic research that you made by studying those people, and instead of putting it into practice, you wrote a book. I don't want to learn from you. You don't know anything. You know theories. I don't need theories. I need real deal. I need the real deal here. And I got mad. I got really mad. And so I started to go out with my business partner, AJ, because he was really good with the opposite sex. And it was fun to sort of blend all of our negotiation and network stuff into like dating stuff. And then we started getting into these guys who were kind of like these dating coach dudes. And we started mixing their teaching in, and we found the exact same phenomenon with them. 99% of them were internet marketers that would scare any female away within 100 feet. They had no idea what they were doing. They were just trying to sell ebooks. So what we found is a really big gap in application and bullshit theory that people were proffering on the internet. And what we were doing was debunking all that stuff for ourselves by going out, trying it, breaking it, improving it, and then coming up with new technology. And we were talking about this stuff for hours every night of the week. We went out for a year and a half, like six nights a week, and just applied stuff. And people started to pay us to learn from us. Guys who we met at the bars and people we met at school were like, hey, can you teach this to me? I'll pay for your food and your drinks if you just teach this to me. So we were doing that. And people kept saying, you should write a book. You should write a book. And I thought, I'm studying for the bar exam in New York. I'm not writing shit. And AJ was a cancer biologist. He didn't have time for that. So we started, AJ, one day we're drinking and he goes, hey, there's this new thing called podcasting. We should just talk and record our conversations and put them on the internet. Then we don't have to write this book. We don't have to burn CDs and give those away and sell those things. What do you think? And so we did that, and that was how the show was born, and now we're in the iTunes top 50.
Yeah, very, very cool. The Art of Charm, was that the original name, or did it change?
It was about dating, but so the name changed a couple years ago, but I don't really want to like bring up all that because when people Google it, it searched back to us and also into like controversial stuff where people used that name to try and market their shady dating programs. One of the reasons we changed the name was, one, we changed the focus of the show and of the business. But the other reason we changed the name is because when things get popular, especially if the rest of the niche is kind of seedy, like if you're a financial management guy, you literally have to, it's a never ending battle of people using your branding to sell their crap. And so getting a fresh start with the Art of Charm was really nice. Because now we just basically have like an entire legal team that sends C&D letters and files lawsuits against everybody. And it's a bummer because I don't like being that way. But now that we're in the quote unquote internet marketing world, I've just found, wow, like everyone is out to steal from successful brands. You literally are at war with scammers on the internet.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to the importance of being able to pivot. Right.
Yeah.
Because just out of curiosity, and you don't have to get into specifics if you don't want to, but generally speaking, how many downloads were you at per month at that point before you realized, you know, hey, we need to pivot this thing?
Probably around 100,000, 150,000 a month. Yeah. And we were like, look, you know, we're trying to get on bigger name guests and they're Googling us and they're finding like dating coach, pickup artist, dating boot camp. And we're like, we haven't done that stuff in years. We need to change the brand. But my business partners and I were kind of going back and forth, like, what happens if people don't subscribe? And what happens when people search for this and they don't find it? And what happened? People are searching for these terms and stuff like that. And but then what happened was we were getting all these high quality guests interested in coming on the show. And they just kept going, hey, sorry, I can't do it. I can't do it. Hey, I Googled you, not doing it. And we were like, no, but you don't get it. And we had friends of ours that we had made connections with be like, look, the only reason I'm doing your show is because I love you guys. Mm-hmm. But this is not good for your brand. It's not good for my brand. So I would strongly advise you to pull the plug and start over. And we thought, okay, we're going to do a rebrand. And we thought it was going to be this massively painful process. And it took like a couple months. And it's been a couple years. And sometimes people still bring it up, but they usually bring it up in an email about how much they love us and how they've been listening since, you know, back in the day.
Yeah. Talk about the hockey stick, right? Because ostensibly, I mean, we're only talking a couple years back. I mean, when you look at the chart, you're going, you know, bang, straight up, right? So over the last couple of years, what do you attribute that hockey stick like growth to? I mean, because if you were at 150,000 downloads, you know, 2.5, whatever years ago with the old, you know, brand before you made the pivot, got people into the new brand, how do you hockey stick that thing, man? What are a couple of the things that you've done?
Well, one of the things that's helped out a lot is simply having a really good skill set for the craft of podcasting when now it's mostly crap. And I'm just going to be really blunt. Most shows out there are friggin' terrible.
They're horrible.
They follow a cookie cutter formula where they ask people about the same thing. The hosts are usually talentless.
Yeah, here's my list of questions. I'm going to send it to you before the interview. Yeah. Just go ahead and prepare, and I want you to answer these questions.
And you know, you'll be telling a story like I just told about the Dave story, and they'll go, great, great, great. Anyway, so we're running out of time. What's your favorite app? And I'm like, are you kidding me right now? Like, yeah. I'm telling you something that's literally something you're never going to get from most guests on the show based on my experience, and you want to know how I organize my to-do list, you know, get a life, you know? And so I don't even do those anymore. And I get that people are trying to branch off into new things, but I think that most of them are not interested in podcasting at all. They just want a thought leader brand where they make money from launching their stupid product. That's not also cookie cutter crapola.
Yeah.
And so what we did is not do any of that. Yeah. We ignored that completely. We have a very sort of conversational show. We get better guests than other people because we've already got an audience and because we have really good networking connections that we've made over the past few years. Now we're a staple in the iTunes top 50. So when people go, oh, I don't do podcasts, we go, okay, well, look, here are the numbers. And if that doesn't change their mind, then, you know, they've got other issues that we're not going to address, but we very rarely get people going, oh, I don't do those. I mean, 2 million downloads is 2 million downloads.
Yeah, you know? It's huge. I mean, there's a quote on your site where it talks about, I forget the exact guy, but he sold more books being on your show than on CNBC and the Today Show combined. Right?
That was Tim Ferriss.
No, that was Ferriss. There you go. So you know, like, a little somebody out there, what, right. Ferriss something or another. Yeah,
exactly. So like if I'm selling more books than the Today Show and MSNBC put together, you're coming on my show if you're an author.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, man, because ostensibly you are an influencer. And I don't even want to say ostensibly, you're a fucking influencer. I mean, really. And it works in a very simple way. I mean, it's what you and I spoke about, which is that whole brand around push button influence, right? Which is something that people aspire to, but very few people have the ability to really just affect massive impact at the push of a button. And so that is a very, very valuable commodity, right? And there is no doubt in my mind whatsoever that that commodity is monetizable in a way that sort of borderlines advertorial and just straight, you know, content, if you will. Because like, if you look at the Vine space, if you look at the YouTube space, et cetera, I mean, these guys are getting 30 to 60 grand on a single Vine because it'll be, you know, it'll be looped 2, 3, 4 million times.
Yeah.
So are people throwing money at you and do you accept it? Or do you, I mean, if it's, you know, if it's cool to talk about, I'd love to hear your take on it.
Yeah, I do to a certain extent. Like if I get a product and I like it, I often will promote it for free. But I don't solicit that. So when people go, will you try my thingamabob? I'm usually like, you can send it, but I'm not agreeing to advertise it if I like it. You can send it. I may very well donate it. I get t-shirts and crap like that every week, and most of it goes straight to Goodwill because I'm not here to advertise your clothing line. I don't care about that. Sorry, to be blunt. And same thing with apps. Most people go, try this. It'll change the way you do XYZ. And I'm like, I'm not going to spend time on that. Sorry. And I don't do that whole like, yeah, sure, cool. So a lot of people might think, wow, this guy's really brash, because I will tell you that I won't look at it. You know, somebody will send me their book and I'll just say, I'm not going to read this. You know, I don't know you. Sorry. But when it comes to advertisements, if a company goes through, especially our ad agency, and says, look, this is a service, stamps.com, for example, you don't have to go to the post office anymore. And I go, wow, I really don't like going to the post office. It's awful. So this is going to be a good product, maybe. Send me a free trial, and I'm probably not going to do it, but I'll have my assistant check it out. And if she's like, yeah, this is really neat, you can weigh a package, and you print out a label, and you use it. That's what I say in the ad. Now, I would probably mention that for free, but I'm not going to, because I have a huge waiting list of people waiting for paid placement. So there's a lot of products that I love that I've bought myself that I advertise, like Clear Card, you know, that card that you get where you skip the airport line. I bought that and I emailed them. I was like, I love this. I'm going to mention it on the show. Send me some talking points and maybe a promo code. And they were like, cool, here's that. And also a bunch of free year-long subscriptions that you can give away to people. And I was like, great. So I hooked up all my friends and family. Mm-hmm. And
But I don't want to gloss over that, though, because you mentioned paid placement.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, when you go to a movie and you see a bottle of Coke, you know, sitting there on the kitchen counter, that's what a lot of people would call paid placement. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm not like, I'm just having a glass of ice cold Coca-Cola. I'm not doing that, right? Like, I'll say, hey, I want to take a minute and thank our sponsor. It's this nice, sleek audio case. It keeps my headphones dry and, you know, because I'm always doing shows out in the rain. I'll do that. And it's clearly a sponsorship. Or if I find people who've, after a sponsor, have been like, yo, I bought one of those sleek cases and they're amazing, I'll go, great, call me and we'll do a thing where I say, my name is John and I'm a sleek audio case customer. I chose this case because it's waterproof and I'm always on my boat fishing and I love to listen to music. So I'll play that, right? But it's clearly a sponsored placement and people get that it pays for the show. And once a month I'll get one email that says, you know, I don't like the ads. And I say, great, I'll edit out all the ads in every show for you if you give me $10,000, because that's what your ears are worth over the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. And it's going to cost me that much to do. And I don't feel bad about it, because for the amount that it costs me just to host the show, not my time, not anything else, just the cost of hosting, the cost of having a producer, the gear that we're using, I could buy a new Ferrari every single year.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about, just in terms of the CPM, and for those that I'll just, you know, I'll define that, which we're talking about cost per thousand, right? So if you've got 2 million downloads a month, which puts you obviously in the upper echelons of all podcasts.
Yeah.
I think I read a stat that you, to be in the top 1% of all podcasts, you need to be around 42,000 downloads a month. So you can imagine what percentile you guys are in. But how? What's the going rate? Like, as we sit here today, what, and you said the ears, you know, there were $10,000 over the course of a couple of years. What's the going rate in terms of per thousand listeners right now?
We charge about $40. Sometimes we'll discount that per thousand listeners per spot. And, you know, I'll do deals if somebody's like, look, I'm a startup, I'm bootstrapping, you know, then I'll cut them a deal. But mostly it's bigger brands that are buying things like, all right, we want 16 weeks of the show. You know, we want four. I think stamps.com just bought 40 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
For all of next year, and they locked in at a lower rate because they're just cutting us a huge check, you know, and that's okay. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are willing to pay more that I won't advertise for, and I don't think I should mention who they are, but sure. There's a lot of gambling sites and stuff like that that are like, look, we'll give you $10 more on top of that, but we want prime placement and we want blah, blah, blah. And I won't do it because, one, I don't gamble. And two, I'm certainly not going to encourage people to gamble as a way to make money. That's ridiculous. Yeah. It's totally unethical. And frankly, I kind of don't like that those companies are around. I'm a free market guy, but they gamify a way for you to lose money that you need for other things, which I think sucks. So yeah. I will not do it.
I won't tell my cousin who's the CEO of DraftKings, you know, at all. He won't see that part of the interview. But
That's funny that he's the CEO of DraftKings. Yeah. And so, for example, I mean, great business, cool. If they offered me a job as a spokesperson, I would say no. Mm-hmm. Even if it was $1 million a year gig, I don't care.
Yeah, I'm kind of a knucklehead, man. But am I doing the math right? Is that $80,000 per spot? If it's
no.
2 million, no. What's
no,
that?
No, because that's monthly downloads. Not all of those people are listening to the same show. That's like across all the shows and a whole catalog. So one show may net anywhere from 6 to 10,000. It depends on the sponsors and their rates, but it can. And sometimes I put my own ads in there from our own products and services. And it's funny because our ad agent is like, "Why are you doing that? You can make $5,000 off advertising for, like you said, DraftKings." And I'll say, yeah, but I can make $50,000 advertising our products and services in the same spot.
And so, let's talk about that. How are you pushing people from sort of the ear, if you will, to the fingers in the wallet? How are you monetizing that audience? Like, give us an example of somebody listens to the show, they go to perhaps the Art of Charm website or whatever it might be. How about this? What's the primary way that you're monetizing that audience?
Sure. So the primary way that we monetize the audience, a lot of people go, man, you must be rolling in sponsorship dough. I pay my staff with that, my team with that. I buy ads with it. I don't even see most of it. I don't ever really take it and buy stuff with it for myself. It's never a salaried thing. Where we make our money is on our live training programs and on our online offerings. So people go, man, this show is awesome. These guys know what they're talking about. These guys have taught us so much. Where can I get more of this? And the answer is come to a live program in Los Angeles, and we get guys from all over the world. I mean, we literally in our hostel-ish type of classroom right now, we've got guys from Denmark, Australia, the UK, the US, and Canada every single week, 50 weeks plus a year. I should say 40 to 50 weeks a year, not 50 weeks plus a year. And they're full, and we're full already till February, and it's September. And so that's pretty normal. And those are multi-thousand dollar seats in live programs that include accommodation. It's an immersive program. It's a small number of guys. We've got a lot of coaches. It's a really life-changing experience that we provide. And that's where we make the bulk of our money. However, it's quickly being eclipsed by our online networking program, which you can find also at The Art of Charm, where we teach how to reach out to influencers, how to reach upward in your organization, create a network around you, introduce people to each other, offer value to folks. And it's got kids in college who want to learn the skill set, and it's got guys who work for the Central Intelligence Agency who want to learn how we do what we do, because we tend to be doing it a lot better than a lot of their people do. So
yeah, for sure.
We've got people, I mean, we literally have intelligence agencies from Western countries that are like, how do we get this for everyone? And I'm like, you hire us for loads of tax dollars and we go and teach it in person. But I mean, this is something we do pretty regularly. And that's fast eclipsing our live programs.
Yeah. And of course you wouldn't discontinue
the
live programs, because they are the feet or the top of the funnel, if you will, right? That brings people into your other areas of, profit for you. So here's what I need to know, because it's sort of that double-edged sword, because you're at that point now where you can call up a Tim Ferriss, a Seth Godin, a whoever, and just say, hey, you know, I want you to be on the show. And they'll be like, fuck yeah, you know, I'm there. Just name the time. But on the other hand, you're saying that in order for some of the podcasts to kind of, you know, rise to the top, if you will, they've got to have a great format where it's not just, you know, kind of this interviewee, you know, here's my list of questions kind of thing, but also they have to have, in your opinion, some pretty good guests. How do you go about getting a decent guest? It's like the cart and the horse, man, that so many people struggle with. How does somebody who has, you know, I don't know, 5,000 downloads a month, how do they even get a bigger name person on the show so they can continue, you know, to snowball this thing and get larger and larger audiences and better guests?
Yeah. I mean, the problem one, I could say network a lot, build relationships, get lucky. That's a really good strategy. It takes years. That's what we did. But there's also this sort of false premise that people are promoting now. And I think that statement kind of has to do with that, where it's like, well, you got to stand on the shoulders of giants. Oh, if I get Tim Ferriss on the show, it's going to be so great. Oh, if I get Tony Robbins on the show, people are going to listen to me. If your guest is carrying the show, nobody cares about you. So why should I listen to you? I don't have to listen to you. The reason people listen to The Art of Charm is not only because of the guest. It's because we challenge the guest to bring out the best. We just had Gary Vaynerchuk on the show, and we're getting hundreds of emails and tweets that say it's the best show he's ever done, ever. And this is Gary Vee. He's probably done 10,000 interviews.
Sure.
I mean, or damn close.
Yeah.
And so we're able to combine forces with somebody like that to create something that's really good. Additionally, when we have no guests, the content that we create is good. It's not some rehashed crap that's from the internet, which is what most shows are doing. Mm-hmm. They're just going, oh, I'm going to teach people how to make money online. Well, how? You're just copying a formula that you got from like 10,000 other people. Mm-hmm. Why should I listen to this guy? You're a teenager, you know, or whatever. Why would I listen to them? So now the fact is the space is so crowded that there's almost no way that you're even going to get discovered. So if you have 5,000 downloads an episode, yeah, you have a chance to build a real audience. If you've got none, if you're starting right now, you've got an uphill battle. You're probably not going to succeed. And I know that sounds like a really crappy thing to say, but it's true. You're probably not going to make it. So if you're doing it as a hobby, then who cares if you're going to make it? Make what? It's a hobby. If you're doing it for money, move on to the 10 million other things that you can do that will actually make money.
Yeah. And when you go, I mean, it's just like anything else, you know, when you go to the charts, right, and you see the top shows, it doesn't matter if it's Amazon, if it's YouTube, I mean, it doesn't matter where you go, you see the top shows. Those are the ones that obviously are getting the exposure, but they're also the ones that are going to continue to get the views and the plays because they're there. So it becomes like, you know, this upward spiral for the top shows and this uphill battle for the shows trying to break in. So, you know, I think we addressed this earlier, which is just you got to do it just because you really want to do it first.
Yeah.
And anything that happens after, you know, is really just, you know, sort of a byproduct of that passion, if you will. But I do want to talk about one thing real quick, because you talked, you know, earlier about this sort of being a fad and this is a bubble and, you know, we're here in this new sort of space, if you will, of, wow, you know, podcasting is this, that, you know, podcast movement, you know, I had 600 or 800 people there and, you know, people are talking and talking and talking about it. Mm-hmm. What I believe is that it's actually very much in its infancy in terms of its growth, in terms of its reach, as far as podcasting is concerned. Because I think that the Holy Grail is right around the corner, which is Wi-Fi in the car.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and having iOS and Android in your car where you plug your phone in and it's got your crap already there. You don't have to, like, take your line out, tape deck thing, plug it in, manipulate it while you're in the car. No, you just, you'll be listening to Serial or The Art of Charm or whatever at home. And you'll go, all right, time to go to my doctor's appointment. And you'll walk out. Your phone will be in your pocket. You'll sit in the car. And when you turn the engine on, it'll just start playing right from where you left off. It'll be cloud-based. And that's really easy to do. It's just a matter of probably a matter of audio or auto manufacturers being really slow off the ball. I mean, why can't we do that already for the last 3 years? I don't know. But it, probably they have contracts with whoever makes those crappy in-car systems for the next few years that they got to let lapse. But I digress. Yeah, let me sort of what do you call this? Like split this up a little bit, or there's a word that's right on the tip of my tongue. Podcasting is in its
infancy. Smoke as much weed as I do, Jordan. I get it why the words don't flow. Yeah, so freely.
I probably just needed some tea. But here's what's happening, right? It is in its infancy. Podcasting as a medium is going to grow so much. The idea that every schmuck should have their own, that's the bubble. The bubble is, oh man, you know, I'm going to do this and I'm going to become a thought leader and blah, blah, blah. No, you're going to give up because you're not going to make any money, or you're going to write a book and that's going to be successful, or you're going to become a Instagram superstar instead, or you're going to do all these different media and that's going to work. Look at some of these big marketers and stuff. Why doesn't Tony Robbins have a podcast? Because he doesn't freaking need one. Mm-hmm. And he's never going to need one. And you see some of these bigger thought leaders like, let me look at the iTunes. I just had iTunes open. And there's a lot of these guys are getting into it. Like
Michael Port, Michael Hyatt, both of Michael those Port, guys just jumped in.
Yeah. Like, let's see here. I'm going to go to my subcategory, which is management and marketing. And it's a subcategory of business. So number one is Art of Charm. And the number one, and the top 10 episodes are this. This will give you insight if you know how stats work, and I'll explain what I mean in a minute for those that aren't on the same page. Top episodes, Gary Vaynerchuk in The Art of Charm, him as a guest on The Art of Charm. The number two episode, Robert Richman on The Art of Charm. Number three episode, Austin Kleon on The Art of Charm. Episode number four, Smart Passive Income with Pat Flynn. Episode number five, something called the MFCEO Project, which is a new show that's quickly fading in the ranks. Number six, Dr. Carol Dweck on The Art of Charm. Number seven, Harvard Business Review's IdeaCast. Number eight, The Art of Charm. Number nine, Harvard Business Review. Number 10, Smart Passive Income. So not only do we have the number one show in the niche, we've got like seven of the top 10 are Art of Charm episodes. And I'm not saying that because it's like fancy, look at me. I'm saying that because you're looking at some of these other people trying to enter this market, and they're not going to be able to do it. You're not going to be able to compete. So if I click on business, which is the parent category of that, number one is Planet Money. Number two is Dave Ramsey, who everyone's probably heard of. Number three is Tim Ferriss. Number four is Art of Charm. And Tim Ferriss and I routinely switch places all the time in the top 10 in business and in the top 50 in iTunes. So look at the size of those people. And like when I click on this, look who's behind us. Gary Vaynerchuk, TED Talks, way behind us. James Altucher, Zig Ziglar. These people are, Jim Cramer's number 28. It's not even close. You know what I mean? So this is a niche that doesn't necessarily reflect like reality of when you're talking about other media, like television and things like that, radio. Those people are successful in their own way. Do you think you're going to outcompete those people? I think largely what Art of Charm has on our side is we started so early. My number one bit of advice for people starting new shows is start 8 years ago. So, you know, I don't have a lot of advice for people to get in early. You want to be a top YouTuber? Great. Start in 2006 or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And I think to, you know, to that point, right. And obviously from my perspective, I mean, I think we've beat the horse enough here that you're not going to make $1 million in the next year doing this unless you already have $1 million+ platform. I mean, let's be real.
And so you can jump. Yeah, you can jump into that from if you're Jim Cramer and you're like, man, I've got this really successful show. I should do a podcast. You can dump seven figures into the ad and creation budget to create that podcast, right? If it makes sense for you. And that's why podcasting is growing, because ESPN is going to launch yet another show with another amazing personality that's going to crush and bring in hundreds of thousands of maybe even new listeners into the fold. It's us at the top that are getting the attention. There's no trickle down. Nobody's going, I'm going to subscribe to this ESPN show. Oh, look, there's a podcast from 10 million different people about starting a business. I'm going to look all the way at the bottom of iTunes and find those. They're just going to look at the top 50, the top 100. Discoverability in iTunes it's getting worse, not better.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears just for a second here, because I think that ultimately there are the influencers and there are the aspiring influencers, right? Yeah. I mean, I think that's just kind of the two categories. And for those that are aspiring influencers to be able to connect with people like yourself, I mean, it's just like, it's so amazing for them to be able to say, hey, you know, I was on the Art of Charm. So you guys are you're in this just, you know, whatever the fuck you call that expression. I mean, you're in that, you know, perch position where you can really just select who it is that you want to have on your show, because you know that you can really help those people move the needle. So how do you find ideal guests, and what are you looking for in a guest?
Yeah, I'm looking for somebody who's got a unique story and can teach something to our audience in a very practical way. So I love having big names like Gary Vee on the show, but I also love having a guy who maybe like escaped from Iran because he was Christian. That's a really interesting story. And I can ask them, well, how did you make the decision that was going to risk your life and da 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 da? And they'll walk us through that process, you know, or, hey, this guy's like a really well-known fugitive drug dealer guy. Let's talk to him about how he got caught and why. I want that story, you know, I'm not just going to interview somebody who goes, hey, I'm a wealthy guy, let me talk about my way where I make money or something. I want real practical stuff that people can take away. So I need a great story, and I need it to be practical enough that people listening, the second they turn off their radio or their MP3 player or whatever it is, their phone, they go, I'm going to start doing this. Whether that's I'm going to think about this in a different way, or I'm going to organize my sock drawer in a different way, it has to be practical. Otherwise, it's just a nice feel good or maybe feel bad, interesting story, and it's not that useful. So it's got to be both useful and interesting, and that's really tough because most guests are either interesting or they're useful. Very rarely are they both. And that goes double for entrepreneurs, because a lot of times these rich, wealthy entrepreneur guys, they give shit advice like follow your passion. And that's crap. And that's what people say when they have no idea what else they could possibly give out. So they're giving a keynote to a bunch of high schoolers or something, and they say, follow your passion. And everyone goes, yay. But what that means is, it means, I don't know what to tell you. I'm a totally different place in my life. I have no practical information for you whatsoever. And I'm comfortable giving out fluff. And that's not what we do at all. And I want to go back to something real quick. I don't want to say that people starting a business can't make it. I'm just saying this is a crap platform for making yourself well-known. It worked for a couple of people. You're much better off becoming a top writer, a top blogger, a top YouTube person or whatever, you know, creating something really good than you are trying to make it as a thought leader within this really competitive, tiny, controlled space that is podcasting and iTunes. In fact, you know, we were on Sirius XM satellite radio for 3.5 years. You've got a lot better chance of making it getting your own radio show and terrestrial radio and trying to port that audience over into iTunes than you do working your way from the ground up. And it's something that's unique to the platform. So I would spend your time creating really good content in one place and not worrying about how famous you are in that category. We didn't even think about this being a business for the first couple of years. And that's why we had such an amazing advantage, because when times got rough, whereas if you were doing it as a business and your calculation was, is there ROI on this? You should quit when that is that, when the answer is absolutely not, and it never has been, and there's no end to that in sight, you would quit. That's not a good business. This is not going to be a good business. If this is your hobby, eventually you might succeed, but you have to be comfortable with the idea that you never will.
Yeah.
And that's what made us, that we got lucky, because people turned out to want to pay for this information. That wasn't something we had planned for. Mm-hmm. And so we don't think of it like that. And we never have.
And really, really great advice. So, you know, for my small circle of folks here who are on, this is a great opportunity for you to ask, you know, a question of Jordan. We're going to, you know, be here for a few more minutes. But if you have a question, just type it into the chat box. We are on live now. Obviously, for everybody else, this will be recorded, but you guys are on live with us. So if you have a question for Jordan, then, you know, obviously, let's have at it. So go ahead and type it into the chat box, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we can. I want to ask you a question about the freemium model in terms of like Dan Savage, right? And the Savage Lovecast with the Magnum edition and so on. Have you guys contemplated having that sort of structure or some sort of membership type program? Anything in terms of monetizing the actual podcast?
No, it's not worth it. It's worth far more to be able to put a couple of ads on every show in order to sort of break even on the cost of creating it, and then to have that number of people be interested in our products and services and sharing it with other people, than to be like, well, if you want the real deal, you got to pay me $20 a month, because they're going to go, I don't know you. Why should I give you any money, jerk face? Mm-hmm. And they'd be totally right. You have to have an audience already that really loves you to charge them any money. And why would I charge somebody $20 when I can charge them $8,000 and they can come to a live program and get real life-changing results? I don't need to charge dudes in college or people that are casual listeners money for this. I'd rather have them as a fan for free, mm-hmm. at the free level. There's nothing we're doing that is, we have two levels. We have free, which is good to great, depending on who you ask. And we have mind imploding fucking amazing, which is our products and our live training, where we actually interact with people and teach them this stuff and guide them through to real results. I don't want like a half-ass level where it's for $25, you get pretty much nothing, but maybe there's no ads in it. No, just take the ads, man. You know, just and have the show for free. I don't want to deal with even the logistics of having another feed that you got to pay for and blah, blah. The reason Dan has that is because he doesn't have products and services. I think maybe as a book, but that's not going to make anybody. Books have never made anybody money in like the last 30 years. Yeah. So he has to do that. That's how he pays the bills. I don't need an extra $25,000 a month from paid listeners. I don't. It's stupid. It alienates the people that I want I want them the most. I want them sharing this the most. I don't want them going, hey, I paid for this thing, and every day I make a decision as to whether or not I should still do that based on the quality. No, I want them going, this is free and it shouldn't be. Share it with the world. And eventually a certain percentage of those people comes and does a live program, pays for our online social capital networking course, something like that. I really think freemium is for people that have no clue how to monetize in any other way. It's a last resort.
Yeah. No, great, great, great points. Why? I mean, obviously you guys have been around for a while. You've kept the fire up. I mean, that's a whole other story in terms of just sort of that stick-to-itiveness and staying the course. But why do you think the audience has stuck with you? I mean, why is it still relevant to them? I mean, obviously you've got great guests, but I mean, at the same token, I mean, they've heard you now for a while, right? So, I mean, why do you think the show remains relevant to your audience?
The bar's really low. I'm just kidding. I don't know. I mean, the short answer to that is I don't know. But the real answer, having thought about that a lot, is I'm not trying to figure out what they want. So I'm just doing the show because of what I'm interested in. And I very rarely take into account what people as a whole, like the audience as a whole, wants to hear. I'm thinking about them as a whole when I'm interacting with my guest. And I'm thinking about them as individuals when I get suggestions from them. So somebody might be like, hey, you've got to have this dude on. His name is Peter Parker, and he got bit by a radioactive spider, and now he flies around the city fighting crime. I'm like, that sounds amazing. I don't think, would other people find that interesting? Let me take a poll and blah, blah, blah. So what happens is I do enough of these different types of shows that people who are in alignment with what I'm thinking about and are like me, maybe that's like 0.5% of the entire earth, which is a crap load of people. Maybe it's 0.1% of the entire earth, right? Which is a ton of people who's, even if you just limit it to English speaking people with internet, right? That's a crap ton of people. Those people might be like, my mind is exploding because that show was so awesome. And the other folks might go, eh, that wasn't your best piece of work. But then the one I release on Friday is, right? It resonates with them. So I spend no time thinking about what is my audience as a whole going to like? What is the Art of Charm as a whole going to like? I only think about what I'm interested in. And some people love that and other people don't. But I'm playing the numbers game by releasing enough shows every month that some of that stuff's going to hit. And what I've found is that works really well because I'm constantly growing as an individual and I'm basically able to communicate that growth to my audience. So if I do a show with somebody who talks about how they make money from the beach and they used to be in prison and how that's changed their whole life, that's interesting to a huge number of people. And then when I, the next day, do a show about somebody who is in really great shape and is constantly biohacking, that might not have the same level of the same type of audience, but it's probably going to have the same number of people listening. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, since people start to trust the content that I'm putting out and that the AOC team puts out, if they're a fitness only type of person, they might listen to that ex-prisoner type and go, wow, that was great. I never would have listened to that, but for trusting what Jordan and the Art of Charm team are putting on the feed. So we end up being curators, and that brings the audience's interests more into alignment with us. But the reason people keep listening is because they know we're not going to put out crap no matter what. And yeah, so we have a level of trust that we've built over a really long time.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. I'm going to save Chuck's question, I think, for the very end here as the last question. But to James' point, what I think he's really asking, and a question that I had as well, is can you speak to the power of content amplification? In other words, when you take that podcast, do you look to repurpose it? Do you videotape it? If that's even a word anymore, do they even still say that? Do you put it on YouTube? Do you get the transcript? Do you take the blog? If you're looking to really maximize that content, I mean, you get a Tim Ferriss on, do you believe in content amplification or do you believe in sticking to the one medium?
I don't do that. I used to upload the podcast to iTunes or to YouTube, and sometimes people would find us there, but it was boring. And I don't think people want to see me talking into a mic. Maybe your audience does. My audience totally doesn't care. So I don't do that. I don't film them. I don't do anything like that. I have a blog that has a ton of traffic. It's got like 1 million uniques a month or something like that. But the articles have nothing to, it's not like we did a show with Gary Vee. Here's the transcript. It's like, it's totally different. It appeals to the same audience, but it's a completely different can of worms, if I can use that analogy, sure, right? And or metaphor. And it's not the same stuff. So this podcast that if I'm doing a podcast and it's audio only, I don't turn it into like a blog post and then a YouTube video. I don't do that. I have different stuff for different media, and that's worked really well. Some people claim to be able to do that, but when I look at their numbers, they stink and I feel like they're full of shit. Mm-hmm. So I look at these podcasters that are like, oh, I upload to YouTube and I've got 1 million YouTube plays every month. I'm like, okay, well, there's one way to prove
does
that.
Everyone you know, by the way, does everyone you know have a radio announcer voice?
Yeah, like, they all do.
Yeah, okay.
Because they're all internet marketers that talk like really hypey. So I go, great, I'm going to look over at your YouTube channel. Yeah. Let's see, your last one got 3,000 views and it's 3 weeks old. Well, let me do the math here. You're full of crap. You don't get 1 million plays a month. You want to. When you say that, people listen to you, but you don't get that. And the reason is because, and look, if your video has 5,000 views, how many people played through the whole hour-long show of your talking head? Nobody. Freaking no one.
Yeah.
So is it worth it for me to do that and quote unquote repurpose it? Hell no. So yes. Same thing.
So are you saying that your blog then is original content? You actually write? So in addition to the show, you're also writing for your blog. How often are you writing and how long? I mean, what's a typical piece for you? We're talking 500 words to a couple thousand words?
800 plus words. I have a writing team that's awesome and they meet with me and they get ideas from me and then they turn it into a blog post. We have calls. I'll talk about what's on my mind and they research it and they create the content. Yeah, it's all original. It has nothing to do with the topics that the show is about. And it's funny because all these marketing gurus are like, no, you need to have this part and then this goes to links back to that. And I'm like, great. So we tested that. Not even close to the same amount of engagement as just original freaking thoughts. The reason people do the repurposing is purely because they're like, look, I can spend an hour and I can get four different content pieces. That seems cool for people who read the 4-hour work week. It's really a load of BS. It's just a load of crap. If you're a one-man band and time is the thing that you're trying to save for yourself, fine. If you have a team, there's no reason to continually repurpose stuff. It does not return. It just doesn't. And I've never seen anybody prove it to me that it does.
Yeah, man. Well, knowing how valuable your time is here, man, let's throw one more question at you and then we'll call it a wrap. But awesome. Chuck, I think, asked the best question of all, man, which is, you know, what can we do to help you?
Well, subscribe to The Art of Charm in iTunes or Stitcher and check out the podcast and then write us a really good review if you like it, because the reviews are what keep us in the top 50 in iTunes. But yeah, subscribe to the show and share it with as many people as you can if you like it.
Yeah, awesome. And theartofcharm.com is the best place to find out about the show. But if the people want to find out about you, where do they go?
Theartofcharm.com is great. You can also just find me on Twitter at The Art of Charm, and people can email me. I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, I get so much email, I don't give a crap. I read everything. I reply to like 99% unless it's written in broken English or non-English. And yeah, people can definitely, I'm so active on Twitter. It's a shame. It's shameful. And Facebook for that matter.
Yeah, well, I can tell you from my perspective, man, I think what you're doing with the show is amazing. And the fact that you guys have been at this so long, I mean, you deserve all of the rewards that you've been able to get. And frankly, you know, I've already got the contract on the Tesla. And after my show airs, which I think it's going to air in December, right? So after it airs in December, I'm feeling like I can go out and just, you know, write that check. So appreciate the exposure there as well, my man.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Just let me take it for a spin.
Yeah, exactly. Well, man, look, obviously, we could talk all day. I mean, we could talk about you being kidnapped. We could talk about Korea. We could talk about all that stuff. But I think this is the most important area that, you know, that we needed to focus on here, which is just the power of the podcast. And really do appreciate your time. Really do appreciate, you know, the fact that you are willing to teach, because so many people who have this knowledge just don't fucking teach what they know. So, you know, for you to do this, man, I just huge, huge kudos and really honored and humbled that you took the time to be here on a very special episode of Reinvention Radio. We'll talk to you guys really soon.
Thank you.
You just got dismantled. Thanks for listening to Reinvention Radio. For more information about the show and your host, Steve Olscher, visit reinventionradio.com.
One person has the power to change the world, impact millions of lives, and leave a legacy for lifetimes to come. That person is you. In the New York Times bestseller, What Is Your What?, Steve Olscher, award-winning author and founder of the Reinvention Workshop, reveals his proven process that has helped thousands of men and women discover, share, and monetize the one thing they were born to do. Grab your free copy now at www.whatisyourwhat.com/free. That's www.whatisyourwhat.com/free.